Chapter 9. Rising CO2 Levels, the Full Context. The Likely Climate Impacts of Rising CO2 Levels, a Full Context, Pro-Human Evaluation. Here's where we are. The purpose of this part of the book is to evaluate rising CO2 levels, the one and only side effect of fossil fuels that could hypothetically justify restricting their use going forward, in their full context, from a human flourishing perspective. This requires factoring in three variables, which we have now seen that our knowledge system utterly fails to do. 1. The overall benefits of continuing fossil fuel use to human flourishing, which we saw in Part 2, are fundamental to the livability of our world going forward, yet our anti-impact, anti-energy knowledge system denies them. 2. The climate mastery benefits of continuing fossil fuel use, which we saw in Chapter 7, are so enormous that climate catastrophe could only occur with climate impacts that are a complete difference in kind from anything we've seen from the last 170 years of rising CO2 levels, impacts such as a rapid, accelerating, and unstoppable rise in temperatures, storms with multiple times the power of history's worst storms, and sea level rises of feet per decade. Yet, our anti-impact, anti-energy knowledge system denies fossil-fueled climate mastery. 3. The climate impacts of rising CO2 levels understood with precision from a human flourishing perspective, including negative, neutral, and positive impacts. Instead, our anti-impact, anti-energy knowledge system wildly distorts them, denying the significant benefits of rising CO2 levels and deliberately overstating negative impacts. To overcome the anti-impact distortions of our climate knowledge system, we must seek out better sources, a range of the least distorted mainstream and non-mainstream expert sources, and hold them to rigorous standards of assessment, including standards of proper framework and standards of objective explanation. Having sought out these sources and applied these standards myself, in this chapter I will share my current best understanding of the likely impacts of rising CO2 levels on the global climate system, the, let us always remember, naturally dangerous, diverse, and dynamic global climate system. I will focus, above all, on whether there are any impacts of rising CO2 levels that could somehow overwhelm our enormous climate mastery abilities to the point of justifying any kind of restriction of the desperately needed value of continuing fossil fuel use. I will endeavor to hold my explanations to the standards of objective explanation I hold others to, including giving clear explanations of the evidence for my views rather than just invoking authority, being precise, not sloppy, with terminology, magnitudes, and probabilities, distinguishing degrees of known and unknown in climate science and for me personally, and legitimately engaging and addressing competing viewpoints, not evading, demonizing, or strawmanning them. The impossibility of an unlivable Earth. My number one takeaway from surveying a range of climate experts is this. Given what we know about the history of temperature and CO2 on Earth, the widespread idea that rising CO2 will make the Earth unlivable is literally impossible. Our knowledge system communicates that there is a very real possibility that rising CO2 levels will create not just a different and worse diversity of dangerous dynamic climates around the world, but a world with a collection of climates that will be nearly unlivable or totally unlivable for humans. Hence, apocalyptic book titles such as The Uninhabitable Earth. The basic idea we pick up about how Earth will become unlivable is that unprecedented CO2 levels will lead to accelerating unstoppable temperature increases, making Earth a place where our physical bodies, along with many other living things, including our crops, just can't handle the heat. The plausibility of this idea depends on CO2 levels being unprecedented. We get the idea that we are playing God with the mysterious set of forces that is the global climate system, and we are doing so by increasing the concentration of the warming molecule CO2 into unprecedented territory that is already leading to unprecedented temperatures. In reality, there's nothing whatsoever unprecedented going on in terms of the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere or the average temperature on Earth. This is not my opinion. This is the unanimous consensus of anyone remotely knowledgeable about the history of this planet's climate. In fact, if we look at the universally acknowledged history of climate and life on this planet, we inevitably come to the conclusion that rising CO2 levels leading to an unlivable planet is literally impossible, because the planet was incredibly livable for far less adaptable organisms with much in common with us when CO2 was at levels that we could not come close to even if we wanted to. There are four basic truths about the history of climate that lead me to this conclusion. 1. The global climate system is near historic lows in CO2 and temperature. 2. We have no near-term mechanism of reaching even 1/4 the historical high of CO2. 3. Life on Earth thrived at far higher CO2 levels and temperatures in the past. 4. Planetary warming is concentrated in colder parts of the Earth. It is not truly global. The global climate system is near historic lows in CO2 and temperature. All the language of unprecedented and record when it comes to CO2 and temperature is misleading unless it comes with the following qualification. CO2 levels and temperatures are far lower than they have been throughout most of the planet's history. As estimates of historical CO2 and temperature levels show, there are enormous historical changes in climate, including shifts in CO2 and temperature, often going in opposite directions, demonstrating that CO2 is not the overriding driver of climate that it is portrayed as. It can be, and I believe is, a minor driver. Today, from the standpoint of the planet's history, we have very low levels of CO2, less than 1/10 their historical highs, and temperatures. It used to be 25 degrees Fahrenheit warmer on average. Thus, we're not in some unprecedented territory where the Earth is going to be hotter than it's ever been. But could we get there soon? Not even close, because of the next fact. We have no near-term mechanism of reaching even 1/4 the historical high of CO2. Since 1850, all of fossil-fueled civilization has increased the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere from just under 0.03%, 280 parts per million, to just over 0.04%, 420 parts per million. By many estimates, the height of CO2 levels was above 6,000 parts per million, almost 15 times today's level. To get to even 1,500 parts per million, 1/4 of the high, would require us to continue increasing emissions far into the 2100s, well past the point at which we can expect to have ultra-cost-effective non-carbon nuclear energy. Thus, there is no near-term mechanism of getting anywhere close to even historically normal CO2 levels, let alone to far higher levels where life on Earth flourished for millions of years. Life on Earth thrived at far higher CO2 levels and temperatures in the past. The periods of high CO2 levels and higher temperatures are some of the periods of fastest evolutionary progress and volume of life on the planet. One obvious reason is the fertilizer effect. The only way dinosaurs could get so large eating plants is if there was enough fertilizer in the atmosphere to create the necessary plant life. Okay, dinosaurs could live back then, but could anything resembling us? Yes, our evolutionary ancestors lived back then. How is this possible? At 25 degrees Fahrenheit warmer, wasn't it just too hot? This leads us to a final fact about climate that is criminally under-discussed. planetary warming is concentrated in colder parts of the Earth. It is not truly global. The term global warming conveys the idea that increases in temperature will be evenly distributed around the globe. Those of us who live in warmer climates hear extreme predictions about its being, say, 4 degrees Celsius, 7 degrees Fahrenheit warmer, and think, wow, that would be terrible in the summer. But that's not how warming works. The warming and cooling of the planet is concentrated in colder places and at colder times. As the planet warms, it gets warmer, concentrated in the northern polar regions, in the winter, and at night. These are places and times that people generally want more warmth. A warmer world is a more tropical world. In previous much higher CO2 and higher temperature eras, palm trees grew in the Arctic and Antarctic. And human beings are a tropical species. We evolved in the deep tropics, and our bodies can survive in colder regions only thanks to technologies such as clothing and shelter. Is a more tropical world going to be unlivable for human beings? That's impossible. Thus, when we think of the impact of rising CO2 levels, we must recognize that it will be, to the extent CO2 causes warming, a transition from today's masterable global climate system to a more tropical masterable global climate system, not some scorching global desert, as is often portrayed. This dramatically limits how bad climate impacts can be. The only legitimate concern about human climate impact going forward is not an unlivable planet, but rather that the rate of change to a more tropical global climate system would be highly disruptive given our current infrastructure investments, including the location of coastal cities. This by itself takes away any kind of apocalypse, leaving only the hypothetical possibility of disruptive changes that could be catastrophically costly, such as sea level rises that would require large portions of the world to move from current coastlines over some number of decades. That would be very bad, but it would be nothing compared with destroying humanity's productive ability and therefore the world's livability by rapidly eliminating fossil fuel use. So, what types of changes can we expect from rising CO2 levels? At what rates? Can any truly overwhelm the mastery abilities of an increasingly empowered world to the point of being catastrophic? To answer that, we need to understand with precision the key mechanism by which rising CO2 levels impact climate, the so-called greenhouse effect. The diminishing and mild greenhouse effect. The key mechanism by which rising CO2 levels influence climate is known as the greenhouse effect, a warming effect. Understanding this effect is the key to answering the question of what rising CO2 levels will do to climate, as well as why past high CO2 levels did not cause the planet to warm to dangerous levels. Note that all the climate impacts of rising CO2 levels come from warming. While we are sometimes led to believe that CO2 itself influences droughts or storms directly, it does not. It can only influence them by causing more warmth in the atmosphere, which can then influence droughts or storms. The greenhouse effect applies to a certain class of molecules, combinations of atoms, such as water vapor, H2O, carbon dioxide, CO2, and methane, CH4. These molecules, technically called infrared absorbers, have the attribute of temporarily absorbing infrared radiation, a type of electromagnetic radiation that heats the atmosphere. This ends up being significant because whenever sunlight hits the Earth, some of it gets transformed into heat energy in the form of infrared radiation. The infrared radiation is emitted from the Earth's surface and travels through the atmosphere, escaping into space. Without infrared absorbers, the infrared radiation, which we experience as heat, would immediately escape into space. with infrared absorbers, the infrared radiation takes longer to escape, keeping the atmosphere somewhat warmer than it would otherwise be. This effect of slowing the escape of heat through the atmosphere is commonly called the greenhouse effect, based on an analogy to the phenomenon of the glass in a greenhouse keeping plants warm. There are problems with this analogy, but for simplicity's sake, I will stick with the term greenhouse effect. A helpful analogy to understand the greenhouse effect is clothing. Clothing slows the escape of your body heat into the local atmosphere. Putting more greenhouse gases into a system is like adding layers of clothing. All things being equal, the more greenhouse gases you add, the longer newly generated heat, whether heat from a human body or heat reflected off the earth, will linger. Just as a human being with clothing feels much warmer than a human being without clothing, so, thanks to the greenhouse effect, the surface of the earth is many degrees warmer than it would otherwise be. It's important to emphasize that the greenhouse effect is not limited to CO2. In fact, the vast majority of the greenhouse effect on Earth today comes from water vapor in the atmosphere. Water vapor is a much stronger greenhouse gas than CO2. Theoretical estimates have calculated that without the greenhouse effect, most of which is due to the natural presence of water vapor in the atmosphere, the surface of the Earth would be about 33 degrees Celsius, 59 degrees Fahrenheit, colder than it is, meaning a permanent ultra-ice age in which little life could exist. In effect, greenhouse gases are, at least up to a certain point, desperately needed clothing for an Earth that exists in a beyond-freezing-cold universe. John Tyndall, one of the discoverers of the greenhouse effect, described water vapor and other greenhouse gases as follows. He also likes the clothing analogy. This aqueous vapor is a blanket more necessary to the vegetable life of England than clothing to man. What greenhouse effect can we expect from increasing CO2 in particular going forward? To answer this, we need to know the trajectory of the greenhouse effect, meaning, how does the magnitude of CO2's warming impact change as more CO2 is added to the atmosphere? Some phenomena in life have linear trajectories. If the greenhouse effect of CO2 were linear, every molecule of CO2 you added to the system would increase temperature by the same amount as the last one. In some phenomena, the trajectory is superlinear, above linear, or accelerating. If the greenhouse effect were superlinear, every molecule of CO2 you added to the system would be more potent than the last. This is the sense that we get from most popular treatments of the greenhouse effect. Then there are phenomena with diminishing or decelerating trajectories. If the greenhouse effect of CO2 were diminishing, every molecule of CO2 you added to the system would be less potent at warming than the last. Anyone discussing this issue should know what kind of trajectory the greenhouse effect follows. While I've met thousands of non-scientists who think the greenhouse effect of CO2 is a mortal threat, I can't think of even 10 who could tell me what the trajectory of the effect is. Most think it's accelerating. Thus, they hear a prediction of, say, 5 degrees Fahrenheit warming, and they think it will just get warmer faster and faster until the Earth turns into a fireball. But there is a unanimous consensus in mainstream climate science, as well as in most challenges to mainstream climate science, that the greenhouse effect is a diminishing logarithmic effect. The basic reason why the greenhouse effect is diminishing is what is called saturation. Recall that infrared absorbers temporarily absorb infrared radiation reflected off the surface of the Earth. But there is only so much infrared radiation to temporarily absorb. Think of it like putting multiple sunglasses on top of one another. The first pair of sunglasses blocks out a lot of light, leaving not too much. The second pair blocks out a lot of the remaining small amount of light, but overall blocks out less than the last one. The third pair has even less light to work with, and so on. Just as each additional pair of sunglasses absorbs less light, so each additional molecule of CO2 absorbs less heat. By most estimates, this greenhouse effect from CO2 by itself translates into about 1 degree Celsius every time the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere doubles. From a human flourishing perspective, this is a mild effect. This is not an amount of warming that would be cause for concern, especially given that we haven't doubled CO2 even once since 1850, and even under extremely high emission scenarios, aren't expected to until the second half of the century. Indeed, given the benefits of warming and of greening, there are many reasons to desire this level of CO2-induced warming. Thus, on its own, the well-established greenhouse effect of CO2 should be no object of concern whatsoever. Why, then, do we hear so much about the danger of the greenhouse effect that virtually all scientists agree on? Because our anti-impact, climate-distorting knowledge system wants us to apply the high degree of confidence that exists for the greenhouse effect of CO2 to a far more speculative phenomenon about which there is far less agreement. The limited, masterable, and speculative amplified greenhouse effect. The greenhouse effect is a decelerating effect that on its own would not lead us to expect concerning warming in the future. Claims that warming will be far more rapid than the greenhouse effect suggests are based on a significantly amplified greenhouse effect. The main mechanism posited is that the greenhouse effect of CO2 in the atmosphere will greatly amplify water vapor creation in the atmosphere, which could cause much more warming than the CO2 acting alone would. This kind of reinforcing interaction is called a positive feedback loop. While such feedback loops do exist with climate, so do negative feedback loops, such as an increase in water vapor leading to the formation of clouds that block incoming sunlight, cooling the Earth. The more significant a warming prediction, the more it is assuming that there are significant net positive feedback loops as CO2 levels rise, driving the Earth to become far warmer than it would be with just the greenhouse effect. The idea that the greenhouse effect is increased through positive feedback loops is called the amplified or enhanced greenhouse effect. I will refer primarily to a significantly amplified greenhouse effect, as that is the object of potential concern when it comes to climate. There are three crucial things to recognize about the positive feedback loops that supposedly contribute to a significantly amplified greenhouse effect. 1. They are limited by the diminishing nature of the greenhouse effect. 2. Even extreme projections of warming would be masterable. And 3. The extreme projections are highly speculative and unlikely to come true. Limited. Claims of positive feedback loops are made in terms of climate sensitivity. The figure of climate sensitivity, or climate CO2 sensitivity, as I prefer to call it, is the answer to the question, how much does temperature increase when the level of CO2 in the atmosphere doubles, say from the pre-industrial level of 280 parts per million to a future level of 560 parts per million? The IPCC's latest low estimate is that every time the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere doubles, the average temperature increases by 2 degrees Celsius. Its high estimate is 5 degrees Celsius. Note that the very measure of CO2 climate sensitivity captures the diminishing nature of the greenhouse effect. To achieve the same amount of warming, according to the IPCC, whether 2 degrees Celsius, 5 degrees Celsius or somewhere in between, you need twice as much CO2. This means that even in the more extreme predictions of temperature increases, more CO2 will lead to diminishing warming, as every new molecule of CO2 leads to less warming than the last. Masterable. If we combine the limited diminishing nature of the significantly amplified greenhouse effect with our limited ability to emit CO2, even the most extreme predictions of temperature rise would be masterable as far as temperature goes. Let's take the extreme high estimate of 5 degrees Celsius, 9 degrees Fahrenheit per doubling of CO2, which, for reasons I will explain soon, I think is a completely arbitrary projection driven by the anti-impact framework. If this were the case, then if CO2 levels got to 560 parts per million sometime after mid-century, it would, after some time delay, ultimately be 5 degrees Celsius warmer than it was during the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, which means 4 degrees Celsius warmer than it is now. I'll explain in a moment what further increasing the level of CO2 would do. And remember, that warming would largely be in colder places during colder times, with much less warming near the equator. Then, to get another 5 degrees Celsius warmer on average, making the world that much more tropical, it would take another 560 parts per million, which even in the most extreme scenario considered by the IPCC would happen only far into the 22nd century. And that would still be cooler than during some of the lushest times in the Earth's history. There is no out-of-control overheating because the diminishing nature of the greenhouse effect, including the speculative significantly amplified greenhouse effect, means diminishing returns on additional CO2. In such a scenario, we would have plenty of time to master any problems, at least in terms of temperature. I'll discuss the other climate effects in subsequent sections. And if we decriminalized non-carbon nuclear energy, we would have plenty of time to develop the potential of that technology for all types of machines. And that's leaving aside global climate cooling technology, which is almost certainly masterable over the next 100 years. So even an extreme amplified greenhouse effect with a climate CO2 sensitivity of 5 degrees Celsius would be masterable temperature-wise. Highly speculative. That said, there is little to no reason to believe in such an extreme amplified greenhouse effect of CO2, and 3 major reasons to believe that it is yet another distortion of the anti-impact framework. 1. Even catastrophist organizations like the IPCC admit that extreme climate CO2 sensitivity is highly speculative. 2. The temperature record supports a much more mild climate CO2 sensitivity. 3. There are myriad ways in which the climate predictors are inclined and incentivized to make extreme predictions. Even catastrophist organizations like the IPCC admit that extreme climate CO2 sensitivity is highly speculative. Climate catastrophists like to make predictions based on unrealistically high emissions scenarios and using an average climate CO2 sensitivity in excess of the 3 degrees Celsius per doubling best estimate of the IPCC. And even the IPCC admits that the real number could be much lower. The latest 6th assessment report states a very likely range of 2 degrees to 5 degrees Celsius per doubling. This is a suspicious deviation from most previous assessment reports, which provided an estimated range of 1.5 degrees to 4.5 degrees Celsius. Suspicious because past models were already projecting more warming than has occurred. So why do the latest models project even more warming? The increased estimate likely reflects the bias of the models and modelers toward more extreme scenarios rather than toward a better understanding of the climate system. Note that the lower end of the IPCC's long-time range is 1.5 degrees Celsius, not much different from the unamplified greenhouse effect's climate CO2 sensitivity of 1 degree Celsius. This means the UN is admitting no confidence in any significant amplification of the greenhouse effect at all, let alone the quintuple amplification that a 5 degrees Celsius sensitivity entails. The reality of today's climate knowledge is that climate scientists lack the causal understanding of climate needed to make meaningful predictions. This reality is often obscured by the use of climate simulation models, which seem to deliver confident predictions of significant warming that are then breathlessly broadcast by catastrophizing news institutions and politicians. For decades, policymakers have asked climate modelers to predict the future. These modelers use incredibly complex computer programs and powerful computers to simulate the climate future. Climate models look compelling because they show a model of the past that is quite close to past data, making us think that they are based on a clear causal understanding of climate. But the close correspondence to the past is based on curve fitting and post-dicting. It is a math truism that you can curve fit for any pattern of data with a sufficiently elaborate equation or program. Climate modelers can and do tweak the parameters and values in their models until the model feeds back temperature values that match the temperature record so far, even if the model is not based on any real predictive causal understanding. The ability to post-dict in no way means a model will predict the future, any more than an economic model that post-dicts the past will enable you to make a fortune by genuinely predicting the future. Notably, climate models give radically different projections of the future, further illustrating a lack of precise causal understanding. The wide range of models gives a powerful tool to those who believe in dramatic warming or want others to believe in it without having to prove their case. They can just show selective models that make dramatic future projections based on extreme assumptions about positive feedbacks. Again, even if those extreme projections came true, they would be masterable. But my reading of the evidence is that it supports a much more mild climate CO2 sensitivity. The temperature record supports a much more mild climate CO2 sensitivity. Looking at the different arguments about climate CO2 sensitivity, I find the most compelling those that point to the history of temperature and CO2 on this planet, both long-term and short-term, to justify a lower sensitivity. Let's discuss this history again. There is no direct correlation between temperature and CO2. And when one looks more closely at the times they do correlate in past eras, CO2 rises come after temperature rises, not before, due to the rising temperature warming the oceans and releasing CO2. Al Gore misrepresented this in his movie, claiming that CO2 rises came before temperature rises. This does not mean that there is no greenhouse effect of CO2, but it does mean that it has historically been overwhelmed by other stronger drivers of climate, and therefore that the greenhouse effect is not as amplified as the extreme models speculate. An examination of the temperature record of the last 140 years seems consistent with a direct greenhouse effect of 1 degree Celsius with small amplification. One reason is that as emissions have been accelerating in recent decades, we don't see a corresponding acceleration of warming. Additionally, there was significant warming early in the 20th century that cannot be explained by rising CO2 levels, which were too low to make much difference, according to all of today's sensitivity estimates. So there's a strong possibility that there has been natural warming in addition to man-made warming, which also makes sense because the pre-industrial period happened to be the Little Ice Age, an unusually cool period of the Holocene that we would expect to be followed by significant natural warming. For all these reasons, the lower estimates of climate CO2 sensitivity seem much more likely to me. Though again, even if the higher estimates are right, they are masterable in terms of temperatures, and as I will show, in terms of other climate impacts. One evaluation of climate sensitivity using the available temperature data since the 19th century that I find compelling comes from climate scientists Nicholas Lewis and Judith Curry. They find a most likely range of climate sensitivity between 1.05 degrees Celsius and 2.7 degrees Celsius for each doubling of CO2, and conclude that high climate sensitivities derived from a majority of CMIP5 climate models are inconsistent with observed warming during the historical period. There are myriad ways in which the climate predictors are inclined and incentivized to make extreme predictions. As I have discussed at many points in this book, the anti-impact framework drives people, including scientists, to wildly overstate the side effects of fossil fuels. Its delicate nurture assumption leads them to expect greater negative impacts than actually occur. And its goal of eliminating human impact leads them to overstate impacts for effect, so that pro-human people will agree to anti-human impact elimination policies. Our climate knowledge system, including its research funding, has a track record of denying climate mastery, denying CO2 benefits, and overstating side effects. And it has every incentive to err on the side of extreme warming predictions, in part because the more warming models predict, the more today's enormous amounts of climate funding are defensible. Given these drivers, there is that much more reason to believe that while the greenhouse effect is real, the extreme amplified greenhouse effect is not, although if it were, it would be masterable. The only reason to be alarmed would be if greenhouse warming is at the extreme projected end, and that warming leads to other cascading negative climate consequences. But when we look into the evidence for that proposition, it is decidedly underwhelming. What other climate impacts will warming cause? The only way that warming can be a potentially catastrophic problem is if it leads to extreme negative climate consequences, such as dramatically more powerful storms. In recent decades, as past predictions of dramatic global warming have failed to come true, the focus has shifted to these other claimed climate impacts. In looking at the climate impacts of CO2 beyond warming, it is important to remember that these impacts, to the extent they exist, can come only from warming. CO2 increases in the atmosphere don't directly cause anything besides the fertilizer effect, which I've already discussed, and ocean acidification, which I will discuss later in this chapter. So, what climate impacts will warming cause? Fortunately, we have 170 years of recent evidence on this question, because we have had 170 years of warming and collected decent data, particularly in the last century, about the trends of drought, wildfires, storms, floods, and sea level rises. If even a little warming leads to devilish climate consequences, as our knowledge system tells us, then we should see dramatically negative trends in the incidence of adverse climate phenomena. So, let's look at what has actually happened with drought, wildfires, storms, and floods. I'll save sea level rises for the next section, since the trend there is less obvious and requires more analysis. Here, the detailed IPCC reports, which are at their best when chronicling what has actually happened, not predicting what will happen, are instructive. Here are some quotations from AR6, the IPCC's 2021 assessment report. On drought, there is low confidence that human influence has affected trends in meteorological droughts in most regions. On storms, note that tropical cyclone equals hurricane. There is low confidence in most reported long-term, multi-decadal to centennial, trends in tropical cyclone frequency or intensity-based metrics. On floods, in summary, there is low confidence in the human influence. If warming so far has not caused significant negative changes in drought or storms, there is no reason to expect it to suddenly cause extremely negative changes, let alone catastrophically negative ones, even if temperatures increase far more than we have reason to believe they will. With floods, there is some plausibility of an extremely negative change, as rapid sea level rises from warming could create greater flood danger. I'll discuss the evidence for this in the next section. The whole idea of warming being all bad and leading to other all bad climate impacts is clearly driven by the anti-impact framework. There is no way that temperature rises and associated climate impacts could be uniformly negative. In general, warmer is more desirable, especially warming in colder regions, and more warming leads to more water vapor in the atmosphere, which is also generally more desirable. And of course, more plant food in the atmosphere will have many desirable consequences. One plausible negative of a warmer, wetter planet would be stronger storms, though even this is highly questionable. Some scientists argue that because warming tends to occur more toward the poles, that will mean a smaller energy differential between different parts of the globe, causing less intense storms. In any case, there is no physical basis whatsoever for thinking that storms will be the 2, 3, or more times more powerful that they would need to be to overwhelm our climate mastery abilities. For example, one mainstream estimate is that storms will be 5% stronger and 25% less frequent, which would be easily masterable. Given that the planet was once a lush place with CO2 levels and temperatures we would have no way of reaching even if we wanted to, there is no reason to believe that moving us in a slightly more tropical direction is going to be net negative, let alone extremely negative. The only real reason is the anti-impact framework, which causes our knowledge system to dogmatically regard impacting climate as immoral and inevitably self-destructive. The anti-impact framework is also the distorting factor behind an increasingly popular projected consequence of rising CO2 levels that I haven't yet discussed: catastrophic species extinction. We are told that rising CO2 levels will cause a sixth mass extinction, a species extinction so devastating that we literally won't be able to live. Given that previous mass extinctions involved phenomena that blocked out massive amounts of light and warmth, like the giant asteroid that left a 93-mile-wide, 12-mile-deep crater 66 million years ago in what is now Mexico, there is an incredibly high bar to claim that an increase in a warming and fertilizing gas will cause mass extinction. What does the IPCC say about the trend so far? That there is no trend so far of rising CO2 levels causing species extinctions. There is generally very low confidence that observed species extinctions can be attributed to recent climate warming. The world today contains an unprecedented diversity of species. Logically, there is no reason to believe that continuing fossil fuel use will cause anything resembling a species decline that would be catastrophic for humans. As I demonstrated in Chapter 4, fossil fuel use gives us the resources, including the land, to preserve nature. Whereas when we are dependent on biomass for fuel, or, as I discussed in Chapter 6, when we need to build sprawling solar and wind installations, we are much less able to preserve nature when desirable. And changes of a few degrees in temperature are not going to be a problem for most species. Species are already surviving in widely fluctuating temperatures, and many evolved in warmer eras. Additionally, the more CO2 there is in the atmosphere, the more raw plant matter there will be, and the more overall life can exist. Not coincidentally, past species explosions occurred in time periods with much higher CO2 levels and temperatures. Both are generally very good for life. The idea that a warmer and more tropical world will inevitably mean mass extinction is yet another distortion by the anti-impact framework, which causes us to expect that if humans cause there to be much more warmth in plant food, it must mean some disaster. There is no scientific reason to fear unmasterable drought, wildfire conditions, storms, or species extinctions from any amount of plausible warming that rising CO2 levels could bring about. That leaves us with just one hypothetically catastrophic climate-related consequence left to consider: rising sea levels. How much will sea levels rise? The only remaining climate-related cause for concern is rising sea levels. I will address ocean acidification, which is an issue not of climate, but of ocean chemistry, in the next section. Sea level rise is a plausible threat for two reasons. One, it is logically affected by warming. Ocean waters expand when they are warmer. And in general, the warmer the planet is, the less ice there is on land masses like Antarctica, and therefore the higher the seas are. At many points in Earth's history, there has been literally no ice, and the seas were much higher. Two, most coastal infrastructure has been built around the expectation of sea levels not too different from today's. Thus, if a rise in sea levels were fast enough, it could cause big problems. But given human beings' fossil-fueled ability to master sea levels, with millions of people in the Netherlands already living below sea level, and with people able to move over generations, in order to be catastrophic, sea level rises would need to be on the order of multiple feet per decade. Is such a sea level rise even possible? Let's look at the trend so far, starting with the big picture of the last 20,000 years. Contrary to the idea that sea level rise is accelerating in unprecedented ways, it has dramatically decelerated. Our ancestors between 8 and 16,000 years ago experienced very rapid sea level rises. Note that despite possessing no technology to speak of, they did not go extinct. Granted, they did not have large coastal infrastructure at risk, but it's clear that claims about humans going extinct due to sea level rises are absurd. By recent historical standards, sea level rises are so slow as to be nearly non-existent, measured in millimeters per decade, not feet per decade. There is some uncertainty here about the exact amount, with different methods of measurement yielding different results. But even the high measurements used by the UN IPCC are 3.2 millimeters a year, which is 3.2 centimeters a decade, or 32 centimeters a century, since 1993. That's not a rate of multiple feet per decade, it's a rate of just over 1 foot per century. You might be wondering why you hear that sea levels are rising rapidly in certain places, such as Miami, due to climate change. The reason is that our anti-impact knowledge system deliberately misrepresents local factors causing local sea level trends as rising CO2 levels causing global trends. If we look at tidal gauge measurements of sea levels around the world, the best measurements we have of long-term sea level trends, what we see is that some rise dramatically, some fall dramatically, and some stay almost the same. That's because the impact on sea levels of global warming pales in comparison with local factors. Local factors influencing sea level include the following: post-glacial rebound, land masses moving upward after heavy ice has melted off them. Changes in ocean currents, currents move varying amounts of water masses, and changes in their strengths can push more water toward coastal areas, increasing local sea level. Development. On an island such as Manhattan, development can put downward pressure on the land. By comparison with these factors, any current global average trend is, well, glacial. Irresponsible reporting will deliberately choose places with local factors leading to relatively rapid local sea level rises, such as Miami, and blame them on allegedly disastrous global sea level rise. But in reality, sea level rises have been slow, as CO2 levels have risen for 170 years. Is there any reason to believe that they'll go from 1 foot per century to something scary, like multiple feet per decade? Let's look at what the IPCC, which has numerous incentives to overstate any problems, says. In a 2019 report, it was estimated that in an extreme emission scenario, sea levels will rise 33 inches, less than 3 feet, by 2100. Even if this likely overstatement is true, it is completely masterable by an empowered world, a world where over 100 million people already live below high tide in their area, and where enormous fossil fuel productivity can be directed toward relocation of population centers if need be. Further, the same IPCC report projects that if we rapidly eliminate fossil fuel use, sea levels will still rise by 17 inches, about a foot and a half, because of warming momentum already in the system. So no matter what, we'll have to deal with rising sea levels, which we cannot do effectively without fossil fuels. If the IPCC is talking about a few feet per century, why do we hear about scary sea level rises like the 20 feet described in Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth? Gore's claim was based on the hypothetical of if Greenland broke up and melted, or if half of Greenland and half of West Antarctica broke up and melted. While this was portrayed as imminent, in reality, even the extreme projections of melting would take place over several centuries, if not millennia. Our knowledge system and designated experts like to take some dramatic-looking melting of ice or calving of glaciers and make us think that the glaciers are on the verge of disappearing. But melting and calving are part of annual cycles of gaining and losing ice. The long-term trend of glacier melt has been a very, very slow loss of ice. And even at the highest, most improbable estimates of temperature increases, it would still be very slow. Just less slow. There is simply no evidence that we face unmasterable sea level rises. Catastrophic sea level rise is just another distortion of our anti-impact knowledge system, which seeks to stop impacting nature by convincing us that our impact on nature is catastrophic, even when it clearly isn't. Ocean acidification. New catastrophe, same old pattern. Having addressed all the major alleged climate-related potential dangers arising from rising CO2 levels, I can confidently say that the case for climate catastrophe is over. That said, I can also confidently say that as long as we have an anti-impact knowledge system and designated experts, new catastrophe claims will emerge, including new variants on old ones. I can also confidently say that those new catastrophe claims will involve the same distortions as the catastrophe claims I've debunked so far. They will, 1, ignore the fundamental benefits of fossil fuels, 2, especially ignore the environmental mastery benefits of fossil fuels, and 3, wildly overstate the negative side effects of fossil fuels. Thus, when confronting the latest catastrophe claims, we want to be on the lookout for these distortions. At the same time, we are now in a position to bring in a significant context of knowledge when evaluating any new environmental or climate concerns. This context includes the following facts. 1. The global climate system is naturally dangerous, diverse, and dynamic. 2. An unlivable planet from rising CO2 levels is impossible, given the history of life flourishing at far greater temperatures and CO2 levels. 3. Fossil-fueled environmental mastery is an enormously powerful force for addressing any environmental challenge, natural or man-made. Having this context of environmental and climate knowledge, along with awareness of the distortions of the anti-impact framework, puts us in a powerful position to evaluate new climate claims. Let's apply this context to the final, relatively new, catastrophe claim I'll address in this book, one that is not strictly a climate claim, but is often coupled with climate claims: catastrophic ocean acidification. like all the other catastrophe claims, ocean acidification is billed as a catastrophic or apocalyptic phenomenon that necessitates eliminating fossil fuels. Bill McKibben calls ocean acidification the deadly twin of global warming and argues the fact that we have already made the oceans 30% more acidic would be by itself enough reason to get off fossil fuel, even if it didn't do a thing to the temperature. Even before looking into the specific evidence about ocean acidification, what we've learned about environmental mastery and about the anti-impact knowledge system's distortions should lead us to four strong expectations about where the truth lies. 1. Given that life has flourished when CO2 levels were far higher, whatever change is happening to the oceans is from some state where a wide variety of life can flourish to another state where a wide variety of life can flourish. 2. The rate and consequences of the change are being wildly negatively distorted by our knowledge system. 3. No possible negative change in the ocean is going to be significant enough to even offset the benefits of CO2 on land-based life, let alone the benefits of global empowerment. 4. There is a significant ability to master the oceans that is being dismissed. Upon investigation, all of these turn out to be true. Given that life has flourished when CO2 levels were far higher, whatever change is happening to the oceans is from some state where a wide variety of life can flourish to another state where a wide variety of life can flourish. Ocean acidification is an increase in CO2 levels in the ocean, which lowers pH levels. pH is measured on a scale of 0 to 14, with 7 being neutral, under 7 being acidic, and over 7 being basic or alkaline. Given the term ocean acidification, you'd expect current pH levels to be well under 7. But in fact, mainstream estimates of the average pH of our current oceans are about 8.1, estimated to have declined from 8.2 in pre-industrial times, very much in the alkaline range. Thus, we are witnessing very slow ocean neutralization, not acidification. Acidification is a completely unscientific term used to scare us. Just as the climate impacts of rising CO2 levels are characterized as unprecedented and therefore dangerous, so ocean neutralization is characterized as unprecedented and therefore dangerous. But given that atmospheric CO2 levels today are less than 1/10 their historical highs, and life flourished on land and in water during those highs, we should expect that whatever change is happening to the oceans is from some state where a wide variety of ocean life can flourish to another state where a wide variety of ocean life can flourish. And this turns out to be the case. The oceans are vast and diverse, from tropical shallow reef waters to icy polar waters thousands of feet deep. Many of today's ocean species evolved hundreds of millions of years ago when CO2 levels were far higher and temperatures were far higher. Realistic estimates of future declines of the average ocean pH don't show systematic negative impacts on species, and show some species benefiting even when the decline happens in the rapid timeframe of a laboratory experiment. Thus, whatever changes are happening to our oceans will continue to be able to support a vast array of marine life. The rate and consequences of the change are being wildly negatively distorted by our knowledge system. What changes will ocean neutralization bring about? Given that every other impact of CO2 has been wildly and negatively distorted by our knowledge system, we can expect that the rate and consequences of ocean changes are being similarly distorted. And this turns out to be the case. Though continuing increases of atmospheric CO2 would make oceans slightly more neutral, or less alkaline, they could not even come close to making the oceans actually neutral, let alone acidic. Further, realistic changes in pH of 0.1, 0.2, and 0.3 are relatively small compared with the changes that marine species deal with on a regular basis. For example, upwelling events, the movement of large water masses from great depths of the ocean to the ocean surface, can drastically change the pH levels and temperatures an organism is subjected to. And empirical experiments show that many species even benefit from the change. Changes in average pH levels in oceans are much like changes in average temperatures on land. They are not changes from one static state to another, but rather relatively small shifts from one wide range to another. There is no chance that the scale of changes we're talking about could lead to some global ocean die-off. Indeed, the most fertile waters in the world have some of the lowest pH levels. The fear of a global ocean die-off can only come from the dogma that the oceans are a delicate nurturer, a delicate stable system where everything either lives in a perfect balance or dies. Given the actual evidence about the impacts of ocean neutralization, the truth is that no possible negative change in the ocean is going to be significant enough to even offset the benefits of CO2 on land-based life, let alone the benefits of global empowerment. Recall our knowledge system's disinterest in the fertilizer effect of rising CO2 levels on land, which leads to more raw biological material around the globe and contributes massively to crop growth and therefore our nourishment. But when there's a chance that rising CO2 levels will affect some life in the ocean somewhat negatively, as in the case of ocean neutralization, then it's the subject of intense interest and hand-wringing. But from a human flourishing perspective, it makes much more sense to prioritize land-based life over ocean life. Consider, what values are at stake with declines in certain forms of ocean life? One thing that can decline is wild fishing. Another thing that can decline is tourism for areas with coral reefs that are harmed or destroyed. Wild fishing and tourism in reef areas are values, but they are not values on the level of global greening from rising CO2, let alone billions of people having the opportunity to survive and flourish, which is the value we get from continuing fossil fuel use. Recall Bill McKibben's statement that ocean acidification is, by itself, enough reason to get off fossil fuel. McKibben is willing to disempower the world, impoverishing and endangering everyone, in the name of unimpacted oceans. That is the murderous anti-impact framework at work. In addition to wildly distorting the impacts of ocean neutralization, our knowledge system denies the phenomenon that time and again offsets negatives in any and every realm. Fossil-fueled environmental mastery. There is a significant ability to master the oceans that is being dismissed. If lowering the pH of oceans is causing any kind of problem to marine life we care about, we should be thinking of ways to use our intelligence and abilities to change the oceans for the better, whether to directly affect pH or to offset any pH issues with some other ocean-related benefit. Indeed, whether or not pH changes in the ocean are a valid source of concern, we should apply mastery to make the oceans far more bountiful for human purposes. But how often do you hear of anyone trying to improve the oceans? The delicate nurture assumption leads us to think that improving the ocean is impossible. But in fact, the oceans have vast, untapped potential for improvement. As futurist Robert Zubrin explains, the vast majority of the ocean, and thus the Earth, remains a desert. The development of open-sea mariculture could change this radically, creating vast new food resources for both humanity and wildlife. One educational example of how much untapped potential awaits in Earth's oceans comes from a 2012 experiment in ocean fertilization by the British Columbia-based Haida tribe, working with entrepreneur Russ George. The tribe formed a company and dropped over 100 tons of iron sulfate into the open Pacific Ocean off the Canadian coast. The intent was to create a plankton bloom, which in turn would create abundant food for salmon. The experiment was a stunning success, increasing the amount of plankton in the area, which led to an explosion in salmon population in the local Fraser River and the northeastern Pacific. If you didn't know that leading opponents of fossil fuels are on the anti-impact framework, and that the anti-impact framework drives fierce opposition to human-benefiting impacts on nature, you would be surprised by the hateful reaction to the experiment's improvement of the oceans. But at this point, you won't be surprised that, as Zubrin notes, far from receiving applause for their initiative, the Haida and Mr. George have become the target of rage drawn from every corner of the community of those seeking to use global warming as a pretext for curtailing human freedom. He goes on to quote some of the opponents, including prominent climate catastrophist Naomi Klein, who wrote, "If Mr. George's account of the mission is to be believed, his actions created an algae bloom in an area half the size of Massachusetts that attracted a huge array of aquatic life, including whales that could be counted by the score. I began to wonder, could it be that the orcas I saw on a recent vacation were on the way to the all-you-can-eat seafood buffet that had descended on Mr. George's bloom? The possibility provides a glimpse into the disturbing repercussions of geoengineering. Once we start deliberately interfering with the Earth's climate systems, whether by dimming the sun or fertilizing the seas, all natural events can begin to take on an unnatural tinge. A presence that felt like a miraculous gift suddenly feels sinister, as if all of nature were being manipulated behind the scenes." Klein is talking here about something that caused an abundance of salmon and other ocean life, the kind of thing we are supposed to be protecting by avoiding ocean acidification. But as her statement reveals, she doesn't want an abundant ocean, she wants an unimpacted ocean. And she, a proponent of rapid elimination of fossil fuels, is willing to ruin the lives of billions of people to get an unimpacted ocean and an unimpacted planet. The biggest giveaway that an alleged fossil fuel catastrophe, whether the ones I have refuted so far or the ones that will surely crop up in the future, is at least mostly a fraud, is if the proposed solution is to rapidly eliminate fossil fuel use. Anyone with any knowledge of energy who makes a claim about catastrophe that involves eliminating fossil fuel use as a solution is not truly concerned with protecting human beings from catastrophe, but rather with protecting unimpacted nature from the catastrophe of human impact and human flourishing. The path forward on climate. Full steam ahead. I started this part of the book by pointing out that justifying any restriction of fossil fuel use would require that fossil fuel's side effect of rising CO2 levels have truly catastrophic impacts on the global climate system, as reduced fossil fuel use is itself catastrophic for human flourishing. And when we looked into what kinds of climate impacts rising CO2 levels are likely to have, absent the massive distortions and climate mastery denial of our anti-impact knowledge system, we find that there is no case for climate catastrophe, let alone apocalypse. In fact, without the anti-impact framework's deep bias against human impact, we must conclude that there is a very strong possibility that rising CO2 levels will be net beneficial on their own, due to the massive fertilizer effect, plus the benefits of some of the world's coldest places becoming less cold. We cannot be certain that rising CO2 levels will be net beneficial, but we can be certain that increasing global fossil fuel use and climate mastery, if it is allowed, will continue keeping the world amazingly safe from climate and will likely make it even safer over time as CO2 levels rise. And we can be certain that even if climate danger increases somewhat in some places, almost certainly involving a lack of mastery, that will be a small price to pay for people in those places and everywhere else for the overall massively more livable world that continuing fossil fuel use will uniquely make possible. There is therefore a definitive moral case for a fossil future, for increasing fossil fuel use around the world without any restrictions on CO2 whatsoever. As I will discuss in the next chapter, when discussing side effects that governments should address, a side effect should be addressed by government only if it is 1) significantly harmful and 2) reasonably preventable. CO2 emissions are neither. Regarding significantly harmful, it is not demonstrated that CO2 emissions are even harmful at all on their own. And when coupled with enormous climate mastery benefits, the overall effect is that we are far safer from climate. Regarding reasonably preventable, it is conclusively demonstrated that CO2 emissions cannot be reasonably prevented because preventing them is ruinous for the ability of billions of people to survive and flourish. CO2 emissions are the byproduct of individuals using machines to produce values that nourish, protect, and fulfill them. Every molecule of CO2 emitted comes from an individual using machines to try to achieve their goals. Right now, there are some 6 billion people who use less than 1/3 as much electricity as the average American, including some 3 billion people who use less electricity than a typical American refrigerator. Human flourishing requires that CO2 emissions increase. Even in the empowered world, there are massive direct and indirect benefits to be gained from unrestricted CO2 emissions. This includes the vast majority of people rising to the level of prosperity of today's wealthiest people, as well as all the indirect benefits of all the time freed up when more energy and machine labor are used. Any given restriction on CO2 will, for example, slow medical progress, leading to countless premature deaths. When a byproduct, such as CO2, cannot be demonstrated to be even net negative, when there is significant evidence that it is net positive, and when there is no chance that it is truly catastrophic because its negative impacts are masterable via the benefits that come with it, there is no case for restricting its use and a definitive case for going full steam ahead. This is amazing news because it means that all of the positive possibilities I've discussed in this book are indeed possible, and none of the destruction allegedly necessary to protect us from rising CO2 levels is necessary. Without the pall of the belief that CO2 emissions are causing climate catastrophe, it is possible to eagerly pursue global human empowerment, a world in which everyone has cost-effective energy and therefore the opportunity to flourish. That means more and more people will be able to acquire healthy food with a small fraction of their time. More people will have clean drinking water. More premature babies will have incubators. More people will have air conditioning. More people will be able to enjoy nature. More people will be spared the tragedy of their baby or young child dying. More people will have the opportunity to get an education and make their life whatever they want it to be. More people will have the opportunity to be fulfilled during their precious time on Earth. Also, without the pall of the belief that CO2 emissions are causing climate catastrophe, none of the past and present destruction done in the name of the climate, nor the far greater future destruction being planned, is necessary. There is no need for murderous international treaties committing countries to CO2 reductions, for national, state, and local restrictions on CO2 emissions, for preventing poor countries from developing to their full potential, for mass blackouts in California and Texas, for fraudulent and impossible corporate net zero commitments, for making heating so expensive that more people freeze to death in the winter, for making air conditioning unaffordable, and for the unnecessary misery due to unwarranted fears of climate apocalypse that have been added to at least hundreds of millions of lives, particularly children's lives. Again, the fact that a flourishing fossil future is possible and that the mass suffering of anti-fossil fuel policies is unnecessary is wonderful news. Unfortunately, there are two qualifications to this wonderful news. The fact that a flourishing fossil future is possible does not mean that it is inevitable. And the fact that mass suffering and death due to anti-fossil fuel policies are unnecessary does not mean that they won't happen. Which leads me to the two final chapters of this book, which answer the questions. 1. What policies are necessary to achieve a flourishing fossil future? 2. How can we win support for those policies when so much of the world is bent on eliminating fossil fuel use?